Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard. Soil and greens, really, just a trinket, not a people biscuit. Take my word. It's been said you can't handle the truth, but that ain't so. How do I know?
Hello, listener land. Welcome to another exciting episode of I Was There Too. This is the show where I, Matt Gourley, talk to people present in the great scenes of cinema history. Today, a first for I Was There Too, I talked to Mark Evan Jackson from a film that is currently still in theaters, which meant I had to shower, get dressed, leave my house, get in my car, and drive to a theater to watch it. I struggled to scribble endless notes in a little field notes flip book that just ended up looking like the chicken scratch of a madman. But I was able to decipher most of them and persevere and have a great interview with Mark. I think you'll enjoy it, and make sure to stay tuned after the interview for a clip from an upcoming podcast miniseries by none other than my housemate, Amanda Lund, in a follow-up to her brilliant podcast, Complete Woman. This is called The Complete Joy. It will be available today on Stitcher Premium and Howl.fm or whatever you subscribe to, and it's worth it for this podcast alone. It has guests like Andy Daly, Mark McConville, Maria Blasucci, Molly Hockey, yours truly. I really think you'll enjoy it, so take a listen to a small but not entirely representative clip of this wonderful podcast. All right, that's all the business we have to cover, except to say, since this is a film that is currently in theaters, spoilers abound. Not just spoilers, but pretty much every spoiler for the film. So, if you haven't seen the film, shower. Get dressed, get in your car, go to the theater, watch the film, and still listen to this episode. Even if you haven't seen the film, listen to the episode because download numbers matter. I don't know. You have all the information you need. It's your call. Do what you will, but you don't want to miss this episode. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
The film, Kong, Skull Island. The year, 2017. The role, Lance Atsteen. The actor, Mark Evan Jackson.
Well, Mark Evan Jackson, this is the first time I've watched a movie for this show in a dark theater, not knowing the fate of the subject of my interview. I was very nervous for you knowing that this was like a man on a mission film and how that usually plays out. And it made the experience a little personal and the stakes high at the thought of losing a friend. But then the leader of your scientist party, the Landsat guy played by John Ortiz, and every other single Landsat guy gets killed, except for you. So then I start to think he's going to make it. He's going to be the last of the Blue Jackets.
Yep.
But alas, no. So I want to start this interview with talking about your death line, or more appropriately, your acceptance of death line. You just say, oh dear.
I do.
And I will say ahead of time that there are spoilers.
Apparently there are spoilers.
Yeah.
That'll be present.
Yeah, we're going to start right in with them. As you are just flattened by Kong's foot.
Correct.
So, how did you approach that, knowing you have a great death line, you're going to be killed by one of the most iconic cinema creatures of all time? What were your thoughts?
Well, you know, I this is a layered thing, that there are lots of stories present here. Initially, first of all, my character was not in the movie. My character didn't exist.
You mean the script originally? Or what do you mean?
Yes. Yeah, that...
I thought you had some alternate fan theory where you are just in someone's mind like Cameron and Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Wait, is he not in the movie?
No, there's a fan theory that everything exists within Cameron's mind. That Ooh. Ferris Bueller is like a Fight Club alter ego of his.
Oh, I like that. Have you done that show yet?
No, I don't go in for that shit.
So I read for John Ortiz's role. I read for the role of Victor Nieves. And Jordan Vogt Roberts called a couple years ago. I guess what, like September of 2015, he called and said, I really want to hire John Ortiz for that role. And I was like, hey, that's great. He had just done this great arc on Togetherness with Melanie Lynskey. And I was like, I really like that guy.
Yeah, he's great.
And I was like, that's cool. Thank you for seeing me on it. And then Jordan said, what if we took every time in the script that it says one of the Landsat guys says or does something and made it you? And I was like, that sounds amazing. And so he was like, basically, you're an extra right now, but, you know, over the course of subsequent drafts of the script and as we improvise on set, like, you'll have, you know, you'll be in the movie. And I was like, I'm in. Like, that sounds great. So initially, you know, the scripts go through various drafts. Initially, my death was much different. Initially, my death in the script was then taken by a different actor. So you saw my death, the one as originally scripted. I was giddy, though, when I got the draft of the script showing this one because, oh, dear, is something I say in life.
That's what I do, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was clear that it was written for me because, you know, a couple months into shooting the movie, we get new pages or a new draft, and I'm scrolling through to see how long I last and if it's a cool death. And the words on the page are, oh, dear. And I was like, oh, man, that was 100% written for me, and I can't wait to execute it.
Here's what I love about that. You're playing this, like, sympathetic technocrat.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize your own death. You have a split second as that foot's coming down.
Yes.
And you don't rage against the dying of the light. You mm-hmm. just accept it in this sort of scientist way of like, oh, what's this going to cost? Or what are the implications of this? And
I agree with
how
that.
Is this going to cause waves?
That's absolutely true. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor. So what just happened before that moment was this whole roller coaster of emotion. Like, we're trying to, some of which you see, you don't see it necessarily on my face, but you do see it on the faces of the other actors. Like, we're following Colonel Packard into this, you know, on what may very well be a fool's mission, a fool's errand to try to kill this thing. And as we're, you know, lighting this lake on fire and firing bullets and explosions and flamethrowers and all that, you're kind of like, why are we killing this thing that's keeping the island in check, that's keeping the natural balance? And so there's like rage and, you know, Rambo firing of guns. But then there is also, you know, when we shoot Kong and he falls flat into the lake, then you're like, oh, shit. Well, we did it. Like, oh, no. And there's regret and there's empathy and sympathy. And you wish you hadn't done that. And then, you know, it seems we're successful. And then he rears up and splashes fiery water on my friend Marlo. And I run from that. So, you know, I'm happy to be a part of this project at any level. But there are some things that were left out, some of that connective tissue. So it was that resignation of, oh, dear, came after, like, die, die, die. Oh, no, we did it. We were successful. What have we done? What have we done? Oh, dear. You know.
So did you have a scene where that actually got to see a little bit of your regret in that?
It was it's all kind of montage-y footage of all of us up against the edge of the lake when Sam has the torch in his hand and the lake's covered in napalm and he's luring Kong towards us, that we're firing. And then when we shot scenes where, you know, Kong is splashed down and we think we've been successful and, like, there are tears and honest regret, yeah.
Well, not to take it to anything superficial, but did you just love that jacket you got to wear in that movie?
I love that jacket.
It's very you.
It is kind of me.
Yeah.
It's me in a way that I wouldn't realize. Like, it's not a It's not a Barracuda jacket. Like, it's kind of a...
But it's 70s.
Yeah. No, the second I put it on at my first fitting in Hawaii, it was like, oh. And I was like, what's the story with these? And they said Jordan had them designed. Jordan had them made. They're made after a very NASA flight jacket kind of thing. And I was like, oh, yeah, these... some of these might go missing.
Did you get to keep one? Or you can't say?
All of that stuff is property of the studio.
Okay. So you had worked with Jordan Vogt Roberts before, right? In Kings of Summer?
I had, yeah. I'd worked with him a bunch. Starting, you know, back in the day of web videos and stuff. When my friend Carrie Clifford and I first launched a comedy duo that we do called Sky and Nancy Collins from Orange County, Jordan, I think he was working with T.J. Miller and Mike Bridenstine and Kyle Kinane and a bunch of those dudes from Chicago. And we crossed paths, I think, at UCB one night, and then they invited us to come and start shooting videos with them and stuff. But yes, I've known him for a while, and he directed me in Kings of Summer.
How does he go from that kind of smaller indie film to something like this? How does that even happen? Do you know?
I think that's a fairly common theme these days that, you know, a successful Sundance director that makes a phenomenal film for $1 million or thereabouts is then given $200 million to go.
See it in like a similar genre jump or something, but that's what was so interesting about this.
So Jordan is a fascinating character. You know, we throw around terms like genius and stuff really easily these days, but he really is an interesting dude who super gets it. Like, he's a nerd for the stuff that he loves, which is video games and monster movies and sci-fi and, I mean, all cinema. And he truly, I don't know where it comes from, I think just time on task, but he is one of the very few people that I know. I mean, I know a handful, but he's really up there that understands, like, story and character and comedy and drama and lenses and light. Like, he understands how to frame a scene. He unabashedly loves, like, Michael Bay. Like, he loves, you know, action movies like Bullets and Cars and what was it? Was it Martin Lawrence and Will Smith?
Oh, Bad Boys?
Bad Boys. Yeah. Bad Boys 2, I think he legit loves, which I think he takes a lot of flack for.
Yeah, that's a much maligned film.
I think he loves it. So much so that he sent it up in a show called Mashup on Comedy Central a few years ago. It was a mashup of Bad Boys and Boys to Men. It was Bad Boys to Men, and it was pretty great. It was, you know, a doo-wop ballad during, like, a gunfight, like a Reservoir Dogs gunfight. So he's just one of these cats that, you know, he's very young. There's no reason he should be as good at it as he is, and he super gets, you know, like – The references in Kong that I'm sure I will never understand are deep. And, you know, the allusions to other films and to scenes. And I just love his attention to detail. And he's put that in everything he's ever done. You know, there's a scene in Kong at the top where Miyavi and the guy playing young John C. Reilly are fighting. And the guy draws his katana, his sword. And you just see the inscription on the sword sort of glisten, you know. And it's stuff like that. I'm sure that's a reference to something deep in, you know, comic book or martial arts lore. And I'm sure what that says, it might say death before dishonor. I'm not sure. But it means something. Like, nothing's random.
Yeah, I had fun picking some things out. I mean, obviously, and it's been written about, the allusions to Apocalypse Now are this film. But even the fact that Tom Hiddleston's character is named James Conrad feels like Joseph Conrad.
It does.
A little. And even though you're credited on IMDb as Landsat Steve, they say your full name is Steve Woodward.
Correct, yeah.
And it's the heart of Watergate at this time when this film takes place.
That is a secondary allusion because Woodward Avenue is the main drag up the middle of the city of Detroit where Jordan and I are both from.
Ugh.
Yeah.
So there's no Watergate connection there? No?
Well, I don't know. I mean, mark my words, you'll never see a more screwed up time in Washington.
One of the first lines in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was something. I mean, it comes out of the gate with a bang.
Pretty great. Yeah. I mean, I saw the movie a couple months ago at Legendary and in a screening and, you know, you're sitting in there as the lights are fading to black and you're like, what's this going to be? Like, we shot for 6 months on three continents. Like, I trust Jordan and you know, the studios, obviously, Legendary and Warner Brothers make great movies, but it's like, there could be 1,000 permutations of this film.
Right.
And so you're like, what's this going to be? And the second it begins, you're like, I mean, that very, it's what Jordan, I think, has successfully accomplished in a lot of this film is like, it's scary and fun and exciting, but it's also hilarious. Like, even the very dramatic beginning, like they pan up into a bright sun, and then you hear young John C. Reilly falling through the sky. Uh-huh. You know, like, you hear, it's basically Wile E. Coyote. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's basically a coyote falling off a cliff kind of thing. And you hear his voice like, and, you know, he's just merged all these things. There are funny moments and human moments within fight scenes. There are really funny scenes that end with scary stuff happening. Like, I don't know. He's really good at it, man. I think he's got a bright future.
Did you have any concept of what it was going to be? Or you just really were like, I have no idea how this is going to come out. I mean, you knew the script.
I knew the script.
Yeah.
But, you know, the final rewrite is the edit of any film, I suppose. So you just didn't know, like, on a selfish level, you're like, am I still in this? Because, you know, especially as you're seeing names scroll across the opening titles, you're like, oh, that's right. There are a billion movie stars in this movie.
But you're in there pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Your name, yeah.
Yeah. But, it, you know, you don't know what to anticipate. And right out of the gate, that scene with that happens back in World War II, and then the scene with Corey Hawkins and John Goodman getting, you know, going to Washington to try to seek this piggyback mission with Landsat. Sitting in that screening room, you're like, oh man, this is a movie already. Like, this is about to be a thing. And then the opening titles of, you know, the news footage and Watergate and Vietnam and the scientific stuff, like it's all, it really felt great. You mentioned IMDb, and I do love that all the characters are like Woodward, Packard, of course they're escaping me now, you know, Randa, yeah. All these like last name characters, and mine is Landsat Steve.
I know.
The first day I got to Hawaii and that was on the door of my trailer, I was like, can't we name it something?
It's funny because you have a full name in the movie and you're still named Landsat Steve.
Yeah.
But that's just the key to your character, I guess.
I don't think anything in my life and career will ever go conventionally.
So three continents, you went to Hawaii first and then...
3 months in Hawaii, 2 months in Australia, and then a month in Vietnam. The show was in Vietnam for a month. I was only in Vietnam for a couple weeks.
And did you guys do much in-studio work?
Very little.
Where was that?
That mostly was in Australia, in the Gold Coast. Warner Brothers has a movie world there, and so they have sound stages. It's a, you know, it's Hollywood. I mean, it's a big fat operation. But that was, you know, we did very little green screen. I mean, that's what made a lot of this movie really cool and not have to, you know, pretend. Like, obviously, the monsters weren't there, but most of our locations were practical. Mm-hmm. That's the difference between shooting a Kings of Summer and, you know, a $200 million monster movie. They took apart, I think, four Huey, Vietnam-era Huey helicopters, three, I think, in Los Angeles and one in Washington State, took them apart, put them in shipping containers, sailed them to Honolulu, put them back together, and we flew around on them.
Like, so you really were flying in those things?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was very scary.
And you're firing an M16 all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with full load blanks, which gives you an appreciation for, you know, people that do that every day. Because we, you know, we'd have hidden ear protection and stuff. And one time between takes, I took out one of my earplugs to get notes to, you know, hear the direction and forgot to put it back in. And the second you pull the trigger on the next shot, your ear just goes... And it's painful, and I was asking, you know, we had all these military advisors with us throughout, some retired Navy SEALs and Australian Special Forces and stuff when we were down there, and you would say to them, like, how you don't wear ear protection in combat, right? And they're like, no. And you're like, well, then how do you do it? And they say, you lose your hearing. And you realize, like, oh, these are the toughest humans on the planet.
Yeah.
Like, these guys are insane.
They sacrifice more than you think.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Like, lifelong sacrifices of, you know, changes to their makeup.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the difference, that we were, you know, we did a little bit of green screen work, but like that ship that they go into that's in the Iwi village and the Iwi villages, like that's all real. They mm-hmm. built the interior of the Wanderer, that ship that had washed ashore, and that parallax room exists mm-hmm. where, you know, they can tell the stories of Kong and the dweller, the skull crawler. And, you know, as the as you walk past it and the shapes change kind of thing, like that's all there. The lake that that I die in front of in Hawaii, you know, in the movie, the script calls for a lake to be lit on fire. So they dug a lake, filled it full of water and gas jets and lit it on fire. Like that was real.
Wow.
That guy running next to me who's on fire, well, that was real. Like they lit him on fire. Yeah. We couldn't afford that in Kings of Summer.
So when you say it's horrifying to ride in a Huey,
yeah,
it's just mortal danger or the motion effects, all of it?
So most helicopter pilots, I think, that we worked with have a military background. So they're cowboys by nature a little bit.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of the flying that we did was not first unit stuff. It was second unit stuff. And I, this was the first movie on which I did any, you know, anything major with that. And it's different. Like first unit, you're working with the director and the cinematographer, and everybody's very precious about the talent. And on this, with second unit, and they were totally great. There were no, you know, safety violations or whatever. They're just like, ready, you know, like, and you're like, I have 1,000 questions. Like, cool. Ask when we land. And so there, I have a video actually up on Facebook, of the first time that we were flying into our work site in these helicopters. And it was the scene where we, like the Landsat team lands successfully and starts, you know, we don't run into the monsters. We split off to set up the computer equipment to measure the seismic charges. And so the helicopters come and land, three or four helicopters come and land in this valley in Kualoa Ranch on Oahu. And it looks like Vietnam, like it looks really cool. And they mount us all up and, you know, we're clipped into a 60s or 70s era seatbelt. And I'm shooting out the door of the helicopter, looking back, and I see the other helicopter take off. Our pilots never were like, okay, here we go. Or, you know, and it would be like if this entire room just lifted up, you know, at a 45-degree angle in two planes, like up and to the right. And so you can hear me in this video, like, they never warned us that we were ready to leave. I mean, I can hear that we've spun up and are, you know, they've reached the RPMs or whatever. But I'm filming it back into my left out the open door of a Huey helicopter, watching this other helicopter take off. And then everything within you just begins moving up and to the right at, you know, 70 miles an hour. And you can hear me in this video go, holy shit. And then you hear Corey Hawkins go, woo! But I mean, it, you know, there are a couple photographs I'll put up as well where you see me. My left hand is gripping the seat structure of the seat next to me because they fly these things really close to one another, and that was another horrifying element. So we made this big turn into the right. I always tell people, like, I watch the president's helicopter take off. And it's very gentle, and it sort of ascends and tips forward a bit and then follows in that same vector.
Yeah, it's basically like a Disneyland Sky Bucket ride.
Right.
Yeah.
These things went corkscrew to the right, and then we were facing mountains right away, and again, these pilots are super pro, and we, you know, we made, I don't know, 40 landings that day, probably, like, to shoot that scene of us offloading all that gear. And so what it means is that you're landing, and they want it to seem dynamic. And again, it's second unit stunts. So they're coming in, like, pretty good clip, and then just, you know, flaring at the end and landing. And there's smoke. They drop, you know, like, into smoke, wind indication smoke yeah. grenades or whatever. And so it's scary. And then you take off and they're like, good, going again. And you go and we fly, I don't know how, you know, half a mile away and 500 feet in the air or something. And we're just hovering these two helicopters. And then the one, we were in the second one, the first one would dip and then we would dip behind them. And you're flying really close, like tons could go wrong.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like there isn't a precedent for helicopter accidents in major Hollywood films.
Not that I'm aware of. Well, you do think about stuff like that.
I'm sure.
For real.
I'm thinking about it now, and I wasn't even there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you are like, they know we're out here, right? Like
they've seen Twilight.
Right. Yeah. They've heard of Twilight Zone. But the, you know, tons can go wrong. These guys are really, really good at it. We landed a few times, and then we would shoot the scene. So it wasn't just our helicopters either. We had camera helicopters. Yeah. That were flying around and you know, shooting the movie, obviously, from dynamic perspectives. And at one point, the camera helicopter, we were on the ground and we're, you know, playing the scene of unloading the gear and getting it all set up or whatever. And a camera helicopter, an A-Star, came on its nose. Like if it flies like this normally,
horizontally. He's holding a cup.
I'm holding a pint glass. Now I'm holding it vertically. So picture this is the cockpit and this is the tail.
Okay.
And it was about, I don't know, 60 treetop level, maybe 50 yards that way. And it went from 50 yards that way to 50 yards that way in this much time.
Vertical.
Yeah. Pointing right at us. And it went, bow, and then flew away. And I'm sure they didn't use much of that shot because I know for sure John Ortiz and I were looking dead down the barrel of that camera, convinced that that copter was going to crash. So we're watching it going like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And then it just flew away and went back to one to keep shooting the movie. And they were like, okay, going again. And we jump back in our Huey. And Corey Hawkins and John Ortiz and I are like, did you see that? Like, I was certain that was crashing. That was nuts. It was on its nose, right at treetop level. And it must have been moving 80 knots, 90 knots. Like, it was crazy what just happened. And Javier, one of our pilots, turned around and goes, that's nothing. And he's like, oh, man. Like, don't prove it. Yeah, you don't owe us that.
Just feel like something else is coming when he says that.
They're like, that's nothing. Yeah. So, I mean, these guys are good at it. And I guess you have to have a certain, you know, like, it's like being a surgeon. Like, you have to have a certain confidence if you're going to, if you're going to, you know, go up in a heavier than air aircraft that doesn't glide.
Yeah.
You know? Like, if something goes wrong, there are things they can do, but it's not like you've got wings.
Right. Let's talk about what it was like to work with Kong himself.
So sure.
You actually had an actor stand in for Kong most of the time, or?
No.
No.
That was later. I mean, interestingly, that's.
Oh, so he would do that in post.
Uh-huh.
So,
or in a different schedule of the movie, yeah.
Okay.
And I think a lot of it, I just read an article the other day that I think a lot of that was, you know, hand-drawn by ILM.
Like, really?
Yeah, they did have Terry Notary do some stuff, but I don't know how much of it they used.
And at an Andy Serkis level, that kind of thing.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And I don't think that, so Toby Kebbell, who plays Chapman in the movie, he's the guy that sits on that stick bug that stands up.
Who I thought they were calling Chaplin the entire time.
Oh, hilarious.
I was thinking like, oh, this poor little pastor.
That's amazing.
Yeah. My theater experience wasn't the greatest. 27 minutes of trailers before the film.
Is that right?
It was incredible.
That's too much time.
And the sound was off, so that's why. Anyway, go.
Oh, no. Was the sound off for Kong?
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know. Well, I look forward to seeing it again.
Oh, please.
I mean, I didn't miss anything vital.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And I was taking notes, too, that are, I have them here, illegible. If I were to ask you these questions, it'd be like, in Vietnam is our culture, but that's anyway.
Toby Kebbell did some facial stuff for Kong that I think that they used.
You know,
he's an amazing dude. That he plays Koba in Planet of the Apes. He plays like the villain ape in the Planet of the Apes movies. And he can become an ape. Like he can change the way he moves and it's insane.
So which was he hired for first, Chapman? Or
I think Chapman, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
But he's got such a good mocap performance capture career that I think they asked him. I don't know any of this. This is a supposition. I didn't ask him about this particularly. But Jason Mitchell, who plays Mills in the movie, loves those movies. And when I was there when he found out that Toby was Koba, and he lost his mind. He was like, let's talk about this forever. And he totally geeked out. And Toby Kebbell, so the deck of a Huey helicopter is, I don't know, how high is this? Three and a half, 4 feet?
Yeah.
Toby Kebbell was talking about, that what it took to learn how to embody these primates, that they can jump up to something, and then when they jump down, we jump down from something and we land on 1 foot and keep moving, or we land on 2 feet and stop and then move. They land on 2 feet and are still moving, and you're like, well, that doesn't seem like much of a difference. And when he does it, you're like, oh my gosh, you're an ape.
Uh-huh.
Like you are moving in a different way. You know, he's all hunched like down in a squat. And he can jump from a squat from the ground and land on the deck of a Huey helicopter, unassisted and perfectly balanced. And it's just a thing.
Was he doing this just as a demonstration for you guys?
This is the day that that Jason found out that he played Koba in these movies, and we started talking about it. And it was the day that they took us through the helicopter. So you were asking about the helicopters earlier. They first one of the first days in Hawaii, they have one in a hangar, and we're going through it. And they're like, because they want the actors to not be jerking the yoke around, and they want it realistic. So they're teaching them what some of the overhead toggle switches are and where they might look and the pre-flight checklists and stuff, because they want that all to feel authentic. And they want us to feel as people safe getting on these helicopters. So they tell you what you can grab and what you can't, and don't go around the tail, and, you know, always stay within the pilot's view as you're boarding and stuff. And they're doing all this. And it was a guy named David Paris, who's a former Royal Navy helicopter pilot, and this very cool dude. And obviously, he flew the camera helicopter for Batman versus Superman. So when he was wearing a Batman versus Superman hat, I think, and I said, "Oh, you know, you shot that in Detroit." And he said that he flew a helicopter at 80 miles an hour at 30 feet off the ground up Woodward and up Jefferson and down, like, between buildings in downtown Detroit, which is just the coolest thing ever. But anyway, he takes us through this thing, and he's, you know, got a lovely sort of posh English accent, and he's taking us through and making us feel very comfortable. And the last thing he says is, "All that said, if you don't have to be on a helicopter, don't be on a helicopter."
Jesus.
It was like, what? Well, that just undoes the last 40 minutes.
And also, I don't have to be here. Like,
right.
This is elective in a way, or at least it was at some point.
So it's one, you know, I'm not a super, like, I don't like roller coasters and things. Like, that stuff scares me to death. If I were driving the roller coaster, I think it's a control thing. If I were driving the roller coaster, I would be fine.
You know that roller coasters, you can't drive them.
Not yet.
Okay. You working on something?
I will tell you that when I did the Indiana Jones ride at California Adventure or Disneyland or whatever, one time I was seated in the sacrificial
driver's
seat.
And you think you can control it? Or?
I had a much better experience. I had a much better experience.
It's just a mental thing?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
No, I'm not well. But yeah, the when they took off, like, it was like, oh, no. Like, and then you find yourself searching the ground going, like, do they have a double for me? Do they have somebody dressed as me? Because I may not be emotionally able to handle this. Like, this might be too scary. And like all things in life, the second they're like, okay, that's great. We're done. And you're like, can I take a van down? Then it's a tremendous relief and you're thankful for having done it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. I may not be exaggerating. We may have taken off and landed 40 times that day. And it's like, this is really scary every time.
Yeah. It doesn't get any easier necessarily.
No.
Did you have any physical issues, like motion sickness or anything?
No, but they did for some of the dynamic stuff, you know, at the beginning when the squadron makes the island and there's a monkey there. They did do some stuff. They dressed our stunt team as us and as other, the soldiers that they play in the movie. And they took them up and they made them puke.
The stunt guys?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Who are superheroes? Like, those guys are mostly like military or gymnasts, which is a funny, you know, like, it's a funny merging of worlds. But they're guys that have a lot of, you know, a lot of capability and a lot of bravado, and they, you know, like, they're, and it's fascinating to watch football on Sunday in a bar with these guys because they're in every single commercial. One of our dudes, there's a Daniel Craig Heineken commercial that you probably know where he gets pulled off a boat in he clips in the bad guy into a parachute and he gets sucked off a boat. That's my friend Marla, who was on fire next to me in Kong. Like, so all these stuntmen, you know, like, it's a fairly limited community, and they all, you know, they all know each other, and they're all really good at it.
Did your stunt double look anything like you? I've always wanted to have a stunt.
I didn't
double.
Have a stunt. I had a stand-in.
Stand-in, okay.
Which is mostly just somebody sort of your coloration and your height.
Yeah.
And I had multiples of those. I didn't have a stunt double. I did my own. I did my own death.
That's exciting. What was referenced for Kong when you would do these scenes? I mean, were they just basically look in that direction? Because he's so vast, it wasn't like they had a pinpointed thing that you had to look at.
I mean, fascinatingly, it's exactly like doing it for anything else. It's either a, you know, a tape X on a C-stand. But in this
eye line.
Yeah, just like a simple tennis ball. But they'd put up, you know, like a China ball or something on a you know, various places that we were shooting, because this movie, the scale of this movie was so large. At one point in Hawaii, we had used every crane on the island, every, like, cherry picker and everything. So at one point we were looking up at a mark for Kong that was a cement pumper. You know what I mean? Like a big articulated arm for pouring cement on the high floors of a high rise. And you're looking and you're like, that's not a crane. And they're like, no, it's a cement pumper. We had to, like, we needed something taller because they'd used everything on the island at the time.
I'd love to think there's an episode of Hawaii Five-O that is all static shots for one.
Right. Just because of this. Office. Yeah. So it's in that sense, it's very similar. And the notes were often like a little higher, a little more scared, you know, like, because this Kong was very big.
Yeah.
And is an adolescent, by the by. So he gets bigger for Godzilla, is my understanding.
Really? Yeah. I did stay through the credits.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I had heard about that. So that's very – I really liked the first Godzilla film, or the 2014
The Cranston, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm excited to see where this goes.
I'm excited too. I don't know how they do it, but I'm not a giant dork of the genre, but it was exciting. I knew that it was going to tee up Kong versus Godzilla, but when they, you know, showed Mothra.
Yeah.
And some of the other monsters moving Ghidra. Forward. Yeah.
I'm a middling fan of the genre.
I am.
You know, not all in, but I enjoy it.
But what's the three-headed thing? Is that Ghidra or something?
Is that Ghidra?
Might be.
Let me look it up. Isn't it? See?
It's, I feel like it's Ghorida or something.
That's Ghidra.
Okay.
Yeah. Something. Well, no, now there's King Ghidorah.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
But there's also, wait a minute. Yeah, you're right. It's Ghidorah.
Yeah.
Well, well done. I apologize. Final Fantasy is where Ghidra is. Anyway, okay, I want to talk about something because I had Phil LaMarr on this show, and mm-hmm. he was yelled at by Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction, in character, sir. And you were as well.
Sure.
He found it unsettling and real.
Oh my gosh, Phil LaMarr and I have spoken about this since I got home from shooting the movie. Yeah. No, when Sam there are a couple of different times in this film that don't make it. That we shot. There's the scene. There's some connective tissue that's not expressed in the movie. When I I get separated, so I land with the Landsat team successfully, and then bad things come near us, and I run, and then I meet up with Packard's group.
Yeah, but they don't show how you meet up with them, do they?
No, they don't.
I was going to ask you about that too. Yeah. Okay, good. I want an answer.
That's one little hiccup. Where, okay. And nobody's asked me it yet. Like, how did you get – and it was funny because when we were shooting it, like, wardrobe came to me the morning that we were shooting that stuff. And they're like, hey, we've just been through the script. And I was like, shush, 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 shush. Like, I read it too. I'm not sure. They'll figure it out. And they did. We shot stuff that showed me by myself and coming up over a mountain in a clear – like, as though I would have run – split off from them and then come across Packard and Relis and Mills and Cole and all those dudes. So there's a scene where we're, you know, we've kind of come down into that riverbed where Shay's eating beans.
Yeah.
Where Cole's eating beans.
He also eats those in an instant. They're all there. Then they cut back to him and he's down them.
Yeah. Which may be accurate. That might be a character choice on his part. That dude's amazing.
His death, by the way, was incredible.
Wasn't it great?
Yeah, because it was just a play on what you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the joke beyond the joke.
Yeah.
It's taking a fairly, you know, a set piece, and it's so dissatisfying. You know, I love what they do that to John Ortiz, too, when, like, they're like, oh, they got to the back to the boat, and they're like, oh, I think they have him saying, oh, we're going to live, and then snatch the pterodactyls or whatever come and grab him. And then they cut off his arm for no reason.
Oh, that was gruesome.
It's so great.
When you say Shea Whigham is incredible, what do you mean? He's just a character?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's
– seems like it.
Like, he's my brother now, like, but he is also in real life an older brother, and I'm in real life a younger brother, and we dialed in that dynamic immediately, and I don't know, like, I, you know, it's gravitation, like, it just happens that he's like, hey, you want some coffee? And you're like, yeah, that does sound good. Get me one too? And he's like, hey, man, like, I don't work for you. And we just had that, you know, that, and he would call me, you know, like while we were shooting, Landstat, for no reason, like, which is something that like my older brother would do. Like, and you're like, does he know he's getting it wrong? And he's like, he doesn't care.
Yeah,
like, what's probably the point? Knows, super doesn't care. So yeah, Shay's just like, Shay's the real thing. Like, Shay can embody, you know, obviously I've seen him before this movie, but seeing him in Vice Principals and things, like, he's got such nuance to things, and he's just a killer in this movie. Like, he's absolutely appears as though a guy that's done several tours in Vietnam and is a little off and, you know, probably has some wisdom, but like, don't sleep near him. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, he's a weirdo, with a knife.
Yeah.
But no, he's just phenomenal. I was telling the story. Oh,
yes,
because
so
in
we'll
that,
get back to Samuel L. Jackson. We'll wrap this up.
In that scene, in that riverbed, Eugene Cordero expresses some concern about, like, to Packer, to Sam. He goes, like, hey, you know, some of these guys are civilians. And Sam goes, well, you know, the only difference between a soldier and a civilian is a gun. And Sam gives me the M16. And I have this, you know, exchange with him, like, what am I going to do with this? And I mouth off to him there, and he yells at me, and that didn't make the cutting room floor. And then I think the only one that made it, right, was when I say, we need to go to the north side right now. And he's like, you can do that. You can do that, my man, by yourself. Mm-hmm. When Sam yells at you, like, it feels personal. It feels – there was a scene that we did at the Down Sea Stallion that didn't make the movie either. And we were kind of – it was kind of loose, and we were improvising a little bit. And I improvised a line, and Sam darted his eyes at me in a way that was like, it felt like him saying, like, how dare you speak? And it felt awful. And Sam's tremendous. Like, he's obviously, you know, really good at it and a phenomenal actor. But, like, it lands. Like, when he yells at you, you feel like – you spend the rest of the day going, like, I shouldn't be here. Like, he hates me, and why should I be here? He's really powerful.
What do you think was behind that darting of the eyes? Is it, like, you're messing up the integrity of the scene? You're messing up the efficiency of my work day? Or just, like, this is my scene? Or your best guess?
I mean, you, as an insecure human being, the answer is all of the above. Like, you're sure, like, I've just messed this up. Like, and the remainder of our time on this movie will be – you know, be tainted because I don't think I spoke over him or anything, but it was just, you know, he was saying, let's get these, you know, load up these weapons. And I was like, these are scientific instruments. And he turned like, what, you know, like, oh, now you're going to make stuff up is what it felt like. And it wasn't, it was him being Packard going like, I'm in charge. We're killing this thing. So his thing is completely scenic, but he's just so powerful. Like he's just a presence. And, you know, he's also a very nice dude.
There's a question I have that I didn't know if I was catching a nuance, and I'm not even sure that this was ever spoken about, but in the scene where John C. Reilly as Marlowe meets Samuel L. Jackson as Packard mm-hmm. and realizes Packard's the ranking officer there, mm-hmm. that wouldn't have likely been the case in World War II because it was still basically a segregated military.
Sure.
And it's not in the script. There's no word spoken about it, but I feel like I see John C. Reilly register that and almost kind of go, okay, cool, but – nothing spoken, and it does feel like there's a moment there where he has to, as his character in his acting process, process that.
I think so.
Really?
Oh, I it's not in the script, and we never talked about it, but John C. Reilly doesn't do anything lightly. Like John C. Reilly gets into the world of everything he does. I mean, this is the first thing I've worked on with him, but I can tell you that, like, he does the work, like, and he's not a showboat, and he's not, you know— he's not doing it for anyone's benefit, but what he wants to go into the lens. But he has a process where he like wants to get himself worked up to a point where, you know, like he's not having idle chit chat right moments before we take, he's loose and fun and, you know, amazing to have on set and stuff. But he's like some of that stuff, he needed it to come from a place, yeah. you know, like, and it, I think that's what informs so much of the nuance of like, you know, it's a real no-no, sir. And, just some of his sort of historical references. I love the scene when they're repairing that boat when he says to Tom, like, hold the phone now, Churchill. Yeah. Hold the phone a second, Churchill. I think that I would guess that if you were to have John C. Reilly on this program, he would say, like, yeah, that's definitely something that I allowed to run through my brain of, like, I'm reading his insignias. He outranks me. You know, he's probably younger than I am and is an African-American, and, huh, this is a thing. Like, I don't know. John C. Reilly, I think, was able to really create a sense of reality in what could have been a really slapstick thing in a bad way.
Like, it's refreshing for a blockbuster, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, his, like, even his thing of, like, this is amazing that you're here because I've dreamt of all this other stuff, but you're real. You are real, right?
Right.
You know, like, and he does it in this really needy and vulnerable way. Yeah. And then, of course, so much of what made the movie and made the trailer is stuff that he's made up. Like, there's a lot of improvisation
yeah,
in the movie.
Yeah, you can tell, yeah.
And, And it's stuff that he's, you know, it's all character and it's all truth. Like, it's really lovely.
All right, last question. There's an amazing cut between Kong letting a soldier fall into his mouth and you eating a sandwich. Mm-hmm. Was that in the script or was mm-hmm. that? Okay, it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
The script had it as we shot it as an apple and we shot it as a peanut butter sandwich. That's my friend Josh Funk, who actually was brought on the movie to teach improv for a few weeks at the beginning to especially the Sky Devils. Jordan really wants – he did the same thing on Kings of Summer. Craig Kakowski came to Ohio to Chagrin Falls to teach the young cast to do some workshops with them just so that the, Jordan really wants his actors living in those skins as those characters, like after we've rolled camera and before he's called action. And if he never calls cut, he wants them to be – you know, in that mindset. So there's plenty of footage in Kings of Summer that the kids didn't think we were rolling yet. Like they were just being teenagers punching each other in the arms and stuff. And Jordan had a code word with the camera crew and he would say that and they would, you know, roll and point the camera and everybody would face away and be quiet. But it wasn't like a settled set. Like they were just capturing these guys being them, and tons of it's in the movie. And there's a little bit of that, of us hanging out in the forests and stuff, in the jungles and in the grass and the bamboo forest. That there's some shots like that, some of the beauty stuff, some of the nature stuff. What was the question? Whether it was scripted.
So I love the fact that he brings in an improv coach, as if a film like this would normally bring in like Dale Dye to do a military boot camp for 5 days for the actors, but...
No, he did it with those guys, and then because Funk was with us in Hawaii, Josh and I were going to go play golf one day, and he's like, I can't, I have a fitting. And I was like, oh, for what? And he's like, I guess I'm playing like a crew chief. And then he went and flew around on helicopters, and then he went and did a studio day where, you know, on a gimbal, the hull of an aircraft, and he was in a harness. They had him falling and doing that flip over and over and over again.
Wow.
And then it cuts to me biting the sandwich, which is 100% in the script. Yeah.
That's great.
Yep.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Oh, my goodness.
It's great to talk to you about this.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is great.
Congratulations. And you're coming up in Jumanji, right?
Yeah. I have a small role in Jumanji. There's a very fun remake coming Christmas 2017 of Jumanji that I think there's a trailer out now from CinemaCon, but it's a little bit Freaky Friday and a little bit Breakfast Club and very Jumanji.
Really?
Yeah. It's a really fun continuation of the Jumanji lore.
Okay, we'll leave it with that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you to my friend Mark Evan Jackson for that interview, and thank you to you, my friend, the listener, for doing your part. You can do more by leaving a review for this podcast on iTunes, which helps keeps its visibility. Oh, God, I can't talk. Which helps keeps its visibility. Even when I try, I'm adding plurals. You know what I mean. You can learn more about the show at earwolf.com, on Twitter, @IWasThereToo, or @MattGorley. Same with Instagram and Letterboxd, where I keep lists of all the movies that I've watched for this show, as well as all the little films that are referenced in the theme song taglines. But before I go, do you trust me? If the answer is no, I certainly understand that. If the answer is yes, then have I got something for you. My beloved and betrothed, Amanda Lund, created a brilliant podcast miniseries called The Complete Woman, I don't know, a year or two ago, for Howl.fm. Now, she's following it up with a second series called Complete Joy, and it's fantastic. So much so that I would love to play a little bit of it for you now, in hopes that you will sign up to StitcherPremium/Howl.fm, whatever it is at whatever time this comes out, but you can access it from both. And this podcast is worth the small subscription price alone. Here's a little clip where Amanda plays Maribel May, happiness expert and 1960s not feminist. I hope you enjoy it as much as I have.
Now, many of you say, but Maribel, there isn't a creative bone in my body. Well, I can think of one person who might be able to help you with that. You! But not this old bag of bones version of you, your inner child. Sit in a peaceful setting, light a fire, have a few jugs of wine, and I guarantee your inner child will reveal herself to you. And she just might have a few ideas on how to get you started on your creative journey. Here's just a little conversation I had with my inner child, Mirabelle. Well, hello, little Mirabelle.
Hi, big Mirabelle.
Now, Mirabelle, what are some of your favorite things to do?
I like to eat chocolate. I like to ballet. And I love to catch butterflies with my hands.
Enjoy it while it lasts, because as you get older, you have no time for those things.
We don't?
No, we're too busy.
Too busy doing what?
Why, we're cooking and cleaning and raising children and doing things in the bedroom with our husband.
What about the fun times?
There are certain fun times, but they're different. You know, the fun times when everyone's in bed and you sneak out to the fridge and eat the remaining chocolate cake.
Oh, gee. I don't want to grow up.
Well, you have to, Mirabelle.
I won't. I won't turn into you. I won't.
What's wrong with me?
Why, you're not young. You're not carefree. And you don't seem to care about the things you used to.
Well, a lot of people tell me I don't look a day over 22.
Well, you don't look a day over 40.
Mirabelle, you're a brat.
You are too.
I'm not a brat.
Yes, you are.
I'm a nice lady.
I'm a nice lady too.
You're just a little bitch.
Well, you're a big one.
Oh, now I remember why I never liked you.
Well, I don't like who I turn into. So you know what? I might just play with the knives tonight.
Oh, Mirabelle. Well, you have fun with your knives. And one thing before I go.
What's that, Mirabelle?
Tonight, your parents are having company over. You'll get it into your tiny little brain that you need to go out into the shed and light the packing excelsior on fire. Don't do it. It ruins everything. Uncle Bernie is burnt to a crisp.
There's packing excelsior in the barn.
Mirabelle, come back!
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.